Tyler, Cameron, Josh. Dude! Did you do something fun?
No.
Man, that's not fun. David. All right, so. China, violence, death, chaos, destruction. All through the Chinese spectrum of the dynastic circle. Of course, one of the things that created the problems was the European desire for profit. Again, I know it's hard because you've all been indoctrinated with modernist perspectives, but in the eyes of the people at the time, had little to do with race. Although race justified their actions in the sense that they could do what they want because they were better. But at the end of the day, it was all economics. It was all money. The Europeans wanted to gain access to every single corner on Earth to get resources, to fuel their industrialization, to make money. And of course, the only way to do so would be to control those areas. They began, as we've seen elsewhere, pushing into China by looking for any weakness that they could exploit. And of course, sadly, they used drugs, opium, to get into China. And they used drugs to spark not one, but two wars, which, while civilians were generally not targeted, it did essentially prove how pathetic the Chinese military was. And then on top of that, you had the Taiping Rebellion, one of the most destructive events in human civilization, take place at the same time the Second Opium War is going on. So all throughout China, there's chaos, there's death, there's destruction. This ultimately would force the Qing, the ruling dynasty, to realize, kind of like the Ottomans did, if we don't do something, we're going to cease to be. There would be attempted reforms. The first major reform effort took place during the reign of Tongji. It's known as the Tongji Restoration because he was the emperor at the time. But it was not the emperor that pushed these reforms. No. It would be men like Zhenggu Fang, those scholar gentry who formed private armies and become warlords. They were motivated to save their country. They realized the only way to do so is to essentially, going all the way back to Confucius himself, the only way to save the country is to get rid of the root of all problems in any society, governmental corruption. If you could clean up the government, hold the government to high standards, make sure the men in government do their jobs, then you can revive the economy. And if you could revive the economy, then the standard living of the people would rise. You probably don't remember when I talked about the dynastic circle. But if you recall, one of the first things I said is that according to the dynastic circle, It is the belief that the first rulers of every dynasty are great because they do things for the people. Peace, infrastructure, get the economy going. So Zhang Gufeng and other Confucian scholars were like, look, we don't need to reinvent the wheel. History has already shown us what we need to do. So all we need to do it is do it. But this time, they would seek the help of Westerners to modernize China. So they sought to encourage Western investment. They looked for Western money in building railroads, modern railroads, so you didn't have to carry things by ox cart anymore. They also wanted factories to be able to produce things in China. And one of the things they could produce could essentially allow them to defend themselves. Sorry, I thought there was one other click. Modernization of their military. If they could have factories, they could make guns. If they could make guns, they didn't have to send their soldiers on the battlefield with swords and spears and bows and arrows. So if you could modernize your economy, modernize your industrial capacity, modernize your defenses, then you could save China. But these ideas sound wonderful, don't they? Yeah, we're just going to transform the very nature of an ancient society, just like that. The truth is, reform efforts often fail because when times are bad, people are making money. And if people are making money, they don't want things to change. Ironically, as the men like Zhang Gufeng and others were making suggestions to the national government, some officials inside, they were just skeptics. They sat back and said, why are we going to become more like the barbarians? Europeanism, if you will, the European nation states, you know, organized in the Middle Ages. China can trace its history back almost 5,000 years. Why do we want to become like them? It's funny. Don't take this offense. Don't take this the wrong way. But for a while, all I was hearing is that young people were going to teach the older people how to educate themselves. I got a chuckle out of it. I really did. Because what do young people know? You know, what do you know about life? So the Chinese, a traditionalist society that revered age and wisdom, sat back and said, we have nothing to learn from these new kids. They know nothing. They're just like a meteor that falls out of the sky. And sure, we get a beautiful display of a shooting star, but it just fizzles. So any reform efforts were often stymied. If the government said, oh, let's fund this experimental program, the money just disappeared. Plus, believe it or not, the Chinese are racists. They still are today. The Chinese believe they are the superior race. And I use the phrase barbarians. That's literally how the Chinese, even today, refer to outsiders. One of my most prized possessions is I have a map of the world that one of my buddies brought back for me from China. Because he knew, me being me, I would get a chuckle out of it. China's in the middle of the map. You know how, like, on the maps that we have, you know, North America's over here, then Europe is kind of in the middle, and China's over here. Well, actually, for you guys, it would be the reverse. Well, on this map, China is the center of the world. Well, Chinese basically said, they're inferior. We're not going to learn anything from them. And by this point, the Qing essentially lost control over the country. The provincial rulers, aka warlords, they actually had more control over the lives of the Chinese people than the ruling government itself. So essentially, the provincial governors could do what they wanted. And ultimately, we don't have time to get into it, but 1850s onward in Chinese history is known as the period of the warlords. Because some of the men like Jiang Kofang, on a local level, brought in railroads, made factories, brought in Western advisors, purchased guns, created modern military practices. But in the end, what they ended up doing was making armies that were loyal to the warlord, not the emperor. So in the end, the Dongji restoration would fail. It would fizzle. And China would continue to limp on for the next several decades. Questions? Fast forward 1890s. Get to the point where the Chinese Qing dynasty only has two decades left. There was one last effort to attempt to save China, and it became known as the 100 Days Reform. Guess how long this movement lasted?
100 days.
What gave it away? Unlike the Tongji Restoration, which was started by the Confucian scholars, the 100 Days Reform Movement was a top-down effort where the emperor, Guangzhou himself, wanted to attempt to save China. Ironically, what motivated him was the fact that the barbarians exposed how weak China had become. Beginning with the Opium Wars, all of the Europeans imposed upon China those unequal treaties. First it was England, then came France, then came the United States, then came Russia. Followed by other nations, Germany, Italy, Austria. And there was nothing the Chinese could do about it. And when they tried pushing back, the Europeans started wars. We've already dealt with the Opium Wars. One war that we're not going to talk about is the Sino-French War. That was a war just between China and France, in which France took away Vietnam. And there was nothing they could do. But from the Chinese perspective, the most humiliating loss came in 1895 with the conclusion of what is known as the First Sino-Japanese War, in which the Japanese, who, as we're going to see, engaged in rapid modernization, kicked the snot out of the Chinese. Now, what's the big deal? Well, again, China refers to itself as the Middle Kingdom. China believed it had absolute authority over Asia and the world. But all of the nations just outside the borders, like Korea, Vietnam, Tibet, Japan, those were all viewed as vassal states, which China would tell to move and they would be obligated to move. But now one of these tiny little inferior powers came in and just rolled over the Chinese. This was humiliation, dishonor, beyond imagine. So, faced with embarrassments by the barbarians and the Japanese, the emperor decided it was time to change society itself. We're talking about a systemic change from the top all the way to the ground floor. For example, the emperor and his circle of advisors suggested they need to get rid of their absolute monarchy. They need to abolish the position of the emperor and replace it with like a constitutional monarch. Why? Well, that's the system England had. That's the system that Germany had. So the Chinese decided, or at least the emperor and his advisors decided, if they're the ones who are beating the living tar out of us, maybe that's the model we should embrace. They also talked about capitalism. They talked about opening trade schools, agricultural schools, where the Chinese could go actually learn how to do something that could benefit themselves and the economy. They talked about building a modern military, opening up military academies, army academies, navy academies, to train officers in modern war. They also talked about government taking control over railroads and mining operations. But most significant, there was a call for the abolition of the scholar gentry class. They wanted to do away with the imperial academies. They wanted to do away with the Confucian exams. They wanted to do away with those life gigs that if you passed the exams you could get, and instead replace it with like what we have, bureaucrats. This was a Herculean effort. Because again, they're calling for a complete transformation of the entire society. Unfortunately, the people who would implement these are the very people who stood up in opposition against it. Particularly amongst the conservative scholar gentry, who wielded all the power at the provincial and the local levels. Have you ever had something and someone just told you, give it up? Give me your job, give me your home, give me your laptop. I'm sure you wouldn't say, okay. At least I hope you wouldn't. Ultimately, they condemned these ideas as being too radical, anti-Chinese. So they stood up and they opposed it. Bless you. But most shockingly came when the ruling elite began protesting. Someone within the court sided with them. Shi was the dowager, or the empress dowager. The empress dowager. She started off life as a concubine of Emperor Xianfang, the emperor who was on the throne during the Second Opium War. As a concubine, she was not an empress, but she was the emperor's favorite lover. She would give birth to a son, who, upon the death of the emperor, would be named heir, Tongji. Tongji was her son. But tragically, Tongji died in 1871. It's from the ascension of her son where she would get the status, Dowager Empress, or Empress Dowager. That means she's the mother of an emperor. But because she only had one son, it was her who decided to look within her family and would select another, Guangzhu, to follow her son. Guangzhu was her nephew. So he had been emperor since 1871. Well, much to his surprise, Zhu Xi would lead a faction that, now they couldn't kill him. They couldn't kill him. So what they did is they contended he had lost his mind, seized him, placed him under house arrest, and she would assume control as regent. So she can't be empress. She can't be ruler. Women are not allowed to rule in China, or weren't. But she could rule in the name of. Well, she would use this power to crush all of the reform proposals in which her nephew embraced. All of the leading advocates for the changes were either executed or exiled. They were driven out of China. Any money that was set aside for reforms was embezzled. One of my favorite stories of how she wasted money. She took money, millions of dollars, that was set aside to fund the construction of modern naval vessels. Well, she took it all and had constructed for her a huge yacht made out of marble. And to simulate, because obviously marble does not float, to simulate sailing around the massive marble yacht, she had constructed an artificial lake. So she could go onto the yacht and she could feel like she was cruising. The money that she wasted on that project could have gotten China 10 pre-dreadnought battleships. Well, Zhu Xi stayed in power by removing anyone who spoke against her and filling those slots with people who supported her. Questions? But it wasn't just enough to get rid of the reforms. She and others in China came up with a brilliant idea that instead of changing China and modernizing, that it would be best to drive the barbarians out. Appearing in China was a group of anti-foreign movements. People who wanted to basically go back to the way it was pre-Opium War, where any foreigner would be killed in China. And then all trade had to go through Canton. Oh, and you'd also get rid of Christianity as well.
All right, it's got to go to the next page. No, I guess not. I thought it was. All right, well, fine.
Among the many movements that started, the largest was the Boxer Rebellion, which is going to be talked about on the next slide.
Got it? Got it, Jordan? Cool.
The Boxers, technically known as the Militia United in Righteousness, or by its Chinese name, Juantong, which became known as the Boxers to the Europeans. Because you know why? They did Kung Fu, which there's nothing like it in Europe other than boxing. So they became known as the Boxers because they fought with their fists. Well, the Boxers was a cult-like fanatical movement in which they believed by doing certain martial art forms, they could be energized by the power of their ancestors. And with that power, they would become invulnerable to any type of weapon. As their movement grew from dozens to hundreds to thousands to tens of thousands, they began marching around China seeking to exterminate all foreigners. Christian missionaries in the rural parts of China would be figuratively ripped apart. They would be caught and they would be killed on the streets. But soon the violence in the country focused on the capital. In 1900, a group of boxers descended upon Beijing and would set to attack what became known as the Legation Quarter. Now, if you recall, one of the clauses in the Tientsin Treaties said that the Europeans would be able to build embassies inside Beijing. Literally right here is the Forbidden Palace. These buildings are court buildings. This is the national government of China. But all of these colored in red, those would be buildings all controlled by European nations. So you had British, you had Russian, you had Americans, you had Japanese, French, German, Austrians, Italians. All government headquarters. And many of these buildings were occupied by the families of the government officials that worked in those buildings. So this mob of boxers would descend upon the city and they would encircle it. Foreigners, Christians, Chinese who converted all sought refuge inside the Legation Quarter that was placed under siege for 55 days. Now, one of the most amazing things is that just 14 years later, these peoples would be trying to destroy one another in the First World War. But the Germans, the Japanese, the British, the French, they were all acting as human beings, trying to keep themselves alive. To make matters worse, During the siege, Xerxes ordered the imperial army to join with the Boxers and start attacking foreign businesses all throughout China. Now, here's the funny thing. Documents survived that showed the government officials themselves were split. Well, there were definitely some supporters of the Boxers. Others advised Xerxes that this was going to result in the destruction of China. That this was foolish. Sadly, she did not listen. And man, did the Westerners respond. The British, the Russians, the Japanese, the Americans, Germans, Italians, French, Austrians would establish an 8-nation alliance. They would send combined over 20,000 soldiers to invade from the south, and the Russians sent a 200,000 man army into Mongolia, coming from the north. They were determined to squash the Qing. And the Boxers didn't stand a chance. Again, no offense. If a man comes with you with a gun, and you think any type of spiritual hocus pocus is going to make you impervious to bullets, you will end up as dead as the Boxers did. It just took weeks before the unified force smashed its way into China, made its way to the capital, and lifted the siege on the legation quarter. Then, plunder on a scale never seen before in China took place. By the way, many of the artifacts, Chinese artifacts that are in museums across the world, were taken from China during this chaos. Just FYI. And by the way, not all of it was, actually very few was actually taken by the Europeans. Much of it was given to them by the Chinese, looking for money. Oh, and they also killed lots of people as well. I was only able to find two pictures, but I like these ones so much because right here, this guy, about to lose his head, okay? He's about to get his head cut off by a big-ass machete. Oops, go back. Unfortunately for this guy, the blade, you can see it's all blurred, has already gone in, and I don't know how close you are if you can see it, but there's a nice little dark line that kind of goes like there. The head's already been cut off, it just hasn't hit the ground yet. Anyone suspected to be a Boxer or to have supported the Boxers would be killed. Like this guy. Look, his head is next to his body. But then something unique happened. Instead of the Europeans imposing what they did under the Treaty of Nanking or the Tientsin Treaties or any of the other uneven treaties, all of the eight nations agreed to what became known as the Boxer Protocols. The Boxer Protocols was the idea of the United States. Instead of taking land, instead of taking territorial rights, China had to pay a fine of some 720 million ounces of silver. 720 million ounces of silver, which in today's money, $25 per ounce times 700 with 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3 zeros is $18 billion in today's money. FYI, that was more money than China collected annually in tax revenue. So we're not going to take your land, but we're going to drain your money, which means you cannot resist. Oh, one last thing. And to make sure China paid, China had to accept foreign soldiers. Military units were moved into the legation and at other points around China. Questions? Well, by the time the dust from the Boxer Rebellion settled, China had only about a decade left. The ancient imperial system was on its deathbed. Because as a result of all of the stuff that we've talked about with China and this most recent humiliating defeat, soon secret societies started appearing within China to resist the Qing. Groups, gangs, like the Mafia, groups with the names of the Triads, or the Society of Elders, or the Secret Brotherhood, all these underground organizations had begun appearing. And they started engaging in local rebellions. But no group was able to become powerful enough because they didn't have the money and there were so many of them. But by the end of the 19th century, the secret society's membership swelled when the Sons of Scholar Gentry, or the Sons of the Merchants, began joining these groups. And they brought with them money and Western ideas. These radicalized revolutionaries called for destroying the past in creating a new nation state. One of the strongest advocates was Dr. Sun Yat-sen. Dr. Sun was a member of the Tianhe, which was a very powerful secret society in and around the capital, called the Heaven and Earth Society. They, arguably, was one of the most influential of the secret societies. Because rather than focusing on just violence, they launched an education campaign. Dr. Sun himself traveled extensively around China. He went to the cities. He went to the villages. He went out to the country. He gave speeches and lectures. But most importantly, he had conversations. And soon, his name became synonymous with revolution, particularly amongst the lower classes. Dr. Sun's three principles were simple. A China for the Chinese. He wanted to increase nationalism. He wanted to get rid of the imperial system and replace it with democracy, where the people would have a say. And he also advocated for what today we would call a welfare state. He wanted the government to create a safety net so that way it could help out the weakest among us. His goal, however, was very revolutionary. In many ways, it was similar to the Boxers. He wanted to get rid of the barbarians. He wanted to revive the vitality of China and establish a republic. Questions?
Did you talk about the fate of the lady who was ruling in the name of...
They didn't kill her. They basically put her under house arrest. And Xerxes would die, I think it was 1906. Shortly thereafter. Anything else, Ernest? Okay. All right. As the decade went on, by 1909, 1910, 1911, these revolutionaries soon began forming alliances, if you will, in organizing. They were hostile to European involvement. They condemned the Manchus for not doing anything about it. And they were sick and tired of being controlled by foreigners. So, they engaged in street protests, riots. But they also used assassination and acts of sabotage. And then it's so bizarre. I know I'm going like and then, but it kind of like that's what it was. It was literally like the snowball effect. You had a group, they started to push. There was nothing the government could do about it, so they just continued to push more and more and more. By 1911, almost all of China was in a state of revolt. And there was nothing that the government could do about it. They attempted to contact the warlords, the provincial governors, but the provincial governors sometimes were with the revolutionaries. So unlike with... Unlike the Taiping Rebellion, where the provincials crushed the rebels, by the beginning of the 20th century, the warlords were with the rebels. Of these, the most powerful was a man by the name of Yong Shikai. Yuan Shikai's province had embraced full militarism. He had factories that could not only make firearms, but had the ability to make ammunition as well, bullets. So, with his strength, he would make an alliance with Dr. Sun, and they would form a group, I guess you could call them a political party. The Chinese Nationalists, the Kuomintang, the KMT. This alliance of political revolutionary and military warlord ultimately was the death blow. In February of 1912, the Qing realized their control of China was done. In February, the last emperor of China, Henry Puyi, was forced to abdicate. And with the removal of the emperor, Yuan Shikai and Sun Yat-sen established what became known as the Republic of China. Dr. Sun was elected as the first president, and Yuan Shikai would act as the prime minister. But the republic was very weak. FYI. They never could get their act together. They would be crippled by the Japanese. Not only during World War I, but also during the 1930s. And ultimately, the nationalists would be toppled by the communists in 1949. Although, on the tiny island of Taiwan, the Republic of China, its government still exists. So the Taiwanese are the remnants of the Kuomintang. But, this will be the last click for China, the significance of the creation of the Republic was that it was the death blow to a Chinese system of imperial rule that was in place for 2,500 years. Gone was the Confucian system, gone was the scholar gentry, gone was the bureaucracy. But unfortunately, China, like I said, would descend into chaos. And literally millions of people would die as a consequence in all of the violence that plagued China up until the 1970s. Questions? So, the Europeans took over Africa. The Europeans toppled the Ottoman Empire. The Europeans toppled the Chinese imperial system. Ironically, the only thing that they couldn't topple was Japan. Japan was the only non-Western nation on Earth to avoid a systematic takeover. They did so by simultaneously preserving their culture and embracing Western ideas. All right, here we go. We left off Japan in the 17th century after the Sengoku Jidai, the war of all against all, was brought to an end with the ascension of Tokugawa Ieyasu as shogun. Beginning with Ieyasu and his immediate successors, the Tokugawa decided, after dealing with the Portuguese and the Dutch and the English, that they were sick and tired of the Christian incursion, and they essentially would lock down Japan. So, all of the nations, with the exception of the Dutch and the Chinese, were banned from entry into Japan. And, if you recall, the Tokugawa would create their own version of the Canton system. They banned imports, they banned exports. In particularly, they sought to stop the spread of Western ideas. Silence. I think I mentioned that to you guys before. The movie Silence deals with the Tokugawa lockdown. Although, Shogun has been brilliant, that miniseries, but that's a fictitious story that loosely is based upon. FYI. But that's not real. Although it's brilliant. One of the best things I've seen on TV in many years. It's on Hulu. I think it's on FX too. I think that's the channel it's on, but whatever. All right. Well, anyways, we're going to lock everything down. We also, hopefully you remember, that the Tokugawa maintained control by restructuring society through feudalism, in which all of the daimyo, the warlords, essentially were dependent upon the shogun to maintain control of their fiefdoms. But the shogun would also create a bureaucracy, government agents, who would be related to or close friends with the Tokugawa clan. And samurai were used as police. The bureaucracy made the rules, and the samurai enforced the rules. And of course, there was nothing the people could do about it, because if you recall, Toyotomo Ieyasu, Toyotomo Hideyoshi implemented the Great Sword Hunt. So the samurai would receive a government stipend and would serve as the police. And what they implemented was a completely government-regulated economy. Who grew what? Controlled by the government. Who could sell what? Controlled by the government. Everything was regulated, strictly and thoroughly. Taxes were based upon agriculture, rice in particular. Rice was used to pay taxes. And by the way, you paid your taxes to the samurai, and the local samurai could take a portion of your tax food and use that to survive. Now, they also used labor service as well, so the peasants could be conscripted to make roads, or to make dams or other irrigation projects. The problem with having taxes upon agriculture was it was dependent upon good weather. So economically, so long as the weather cooperated and the crops were abundant, there wasn't a problem. But if there were ever bad harvests, it implemented or implicated the ability of the peasants to pay their taxes. This caused some farmers to open up side businesses, or to use the modern phrase, side hustles. During the Tokugawa period, wealthy farmers supplemented their income by silk weaving, or making soy sauce, or brewing sake, or producing rapeseed oil, which is what the Japanese use for cooking. It was like canola oil. So if there was something that you could produce into another product, you were allowed to do it, and you were allowed to sell those goods. Plus, there were also numerous artisans that produced items. Tools, pottery, clothing. They all could be produced and sold in a market economy. Of course, one of the most lucrative, sword making. And even the daimyo got into the side hustle game. Some daimyo became fabulously rich when they decided to go into banking. Because there were no banks. There were no laws on banks. So if you wanted to start a business, but you didn't have the money, you would have to go to your local daimyo and make a contract. But the problem is there were no usury laws. Usury laws, we have them in our country. Those are laws that regulate banking. The most important thing they regulate are interest rates. So in Massachusetts, banks, credit card companies cannot charge interest rates more than 25%. That would be a violation of state law. Well, in Japan, there was no usury laws. So the daimyo could charge whatever interest they wanted to. And this, I had a translation of it. This is an agreement between a daimyo and a local farmer who wanted to expand the production of his silk weaving capacity. And he was charged an interest rate of 175% per year. So essentially, if the merchant didn't make a whole ton of money in 1 year and pay it off, he would owe almost two times as much as the initial principal. I don't know if he paid it all off. This is just the note that survived. So long story short, you have everybody doing their normal societal roles, but you have others doing these side hustles, and you started having this diverse economy that began appearing. Nothing like it existed in China. But the problem with having a market economy is there are times when the economy booms and there were times when the economy declines. And during the 19th century, the Japanese economy was on precarious footings. Because a bubble was created. Any of you know anything about economics? In your lifetime, there have been several bubbles that have burst that caused people to lose millions and millions of dollars. Like around the time you were born, there was a huge stock market crash because everyone was getting into this newfangled contraption called the internets. And there were all these web businesses, all of the WWWs, that people were going and throwing their entire life savings into because all of these WWW companies would somehow make money. Well, the tech market created a bubble that burst, and the economy entered a recession. And then, around the time that all you guys were around 8, 9, or 10, there was another bubble, a housing market burst. Because banks began basically giving anybody mortgages, whether they could pay it back or not. So you had people flipping burgers in McDonald's, buying McMansions. Well, every time there's a collapse, it's preceded by an expansion. And at the beginning part of the 19th century, the early 1800s, that's exactly what happened. The markets began to expand because you had good weather. So there was more food, More food resulted in more people, and more people resulted in more items being produced. But during the expansion, monopolies started being created, where singular entities would begin taking control of the production of certain items. And daimyo passed laws that allowed the particular business to have full control. The producers who had the monopolies then made deals with urban merchants to basically control and dominate distribution. So, if your daimyo gave you a monopoly to produce soy sauce, you would be the only one in the land that would be allowed to produce soy sauce. You then made a deal with one merchant who distributed your soy sauce. And thus, all of the other soy sauce producers would be put out of the business, and all of the other peddlers of soy sauce would be put out of business. So, the old tired cliche, the rich got richer. But just as everything was going great, beginning in the spring in the early 1830s, Japan suffered for what they called the temple. The temple were a series of famines that would appear in the 1830s and would plague Japan for about 10 years. Because remember, everything is dependent upon food production. Well, beginning in the spring of 1830, 31, 32, Japan experienced climate change, because there's never been climate change before in the history of human civilization before 2024. But actually, it happens all the time. Japan experienced dry springs and then wet summers, and then earlier than expected cold in the fall, which essentially disrupted the growing patterns that had been in place for 30 years. So as a result, food production plummeted. The worst year was 1836, where all throughout the summer, it was so cold that the people wore their winter clothing all summer long. By the way, globally, that was the same. 1836 June, it actually snowed in Massachusetts, FYI. Well, the consequence of several years of bad harvests were several years of a significant decline in food production. And it's estimated when the food diminished by somewhere between 50 and 75%, the people were forced to suffer. They ate weeds, they ate leaves, they ate straw, they ate goose poop, whatever they could get their hands on. Well, because their economy was driven by agriculture, when agricultural diminished, so did the economy. The entire country almost went belly up, bankrupt. Now, of course, ironically, part of the reason for this was because of the Tokugawa isolation. They didn't have the technology to expand agricultural production. Less food, more people equals chaos. And then hand in hand with the famines, riots erupted. which again is part of the tiempo crises. Less food, people taking to the streets. The only analogy that I can give you that you can understand is the so-called summer of love. All of the riots that took place in our country during 2020. It was something like 170 riots in cities across the country. And hundreds of people were killed. It just wasn't covered well in the news. Because most of the people who were being killed went against the narrative that the news wanted to share. Well, in Japan, in 1836 alone, there were 445 peasant uprisings and another 101 riots in the city. Now, ironically, these were not political riots. The people weren't angry at the emperor. They weren't angry at the shogun. But rather, they were like, you know, the lies that we get fed in our country, the socialist stuff. You know, that we have to be mad at the rich. So the rioters went after anyone who had more money than them. So if you were a peasant, but your neighbor had a little more wealth than you did, you went after him. Or you went after the merchants. Or you went after the landlords. But these protests were easily crushed because the protesters didn't have any weapons. So when the samurai came in, tens of thousands were killed. But the most significant reason why I'm sharing this was because observers recognized that the fact that the people were willing to rebel on such a large scale without a leader seemed to suggest that times were ripe for change. But what would the change be? Questions? I should be able to get through this in the last 8 minutes. Do I actually have that time or did I start late? 7 minutes. At the same time all this was going on, within the hallowed halls, there also was a significant intellectual revolution that was occurring during the Tokugawa period. At its core, some of the elites also began pondering change. The Tokugawa system, the Tokugawa shogunate, was not working. Do we change it? And if we change it, what do we change to? Now, traditionally, the Japanese embraced a form of Confucianism, which we've already covered. We've already talked about what Confucianism is. But this was a new form of Confucianism. Shushigaku, or Neo-Confucianism. This spread to Japan during the 9th century. At its core were the same things we talked about with Confucianism. So the five subordinate relationships, filial piety, all the stuff I talked about. Desire to have balance and harmony. But, there was a difference in that Neo-Confucianists believed that one could learn how to better themselves. The most important way isn't just book learning. That was Confucianism. Confucianism focused on book learning. But Neo-Confucianists valued observation. So, they believed that if a person was with superior people, people of a higher class, a higher position, that they could learn those virtues and act that way. So there was a upwards mobility quotient to it. You could better yourselves regardless of your class. Now, by the way, because it involved the reverence of traditions, the relationships, the Tokugawa embraced this fully. So their rule was based on Neo-Confucianism. It was very similar to what was in China. But midway through their rule, like I said, political debate began to take place. And these scholars began questioning the relationship between the Chinese influence on Japanese culture. And they could no longer figure out, okay, what is Japanese? So what they began trying to do is seeing if they could separate Chinese thought and leave a Japanese core. Ironically, this also played out on the relationship between the emperor, who technically is the ruler of Japan, and the shogun, who is the military dictator. After all, if the emperor is supposed to be the ruler, why doesn't he rule? What do we need a shogun for? So, in trying to figure out what to do, two schools of thought appeared. The first is known as the School of National Learning, which in Japanese is the Kokugaku. This is a nationalist movement. So it's not really a school, it's an ideology. They focused on creating a pure Japanese heart by pulling out all of the Chinese stuff. Get rid of Confucianism. Get rid of Buddhism. And instead focus on what is distinctly Japanese. So, going back to Shintoism. Shintoism. The worshipping of the emperor was valued. But at the same time, and this is almost where we're going to end, I just got to do this quick, an alternative appeared. Rengaku. Rengaku similarly suggested getting rid of the Chinese stuff. But instead of just focusing on the Japanese, which is what the Kokugaku wanted, the Rengaku said, why don't we look for better ideas and infuse them in our culture? So this school is commonly referred to as the Dutch school. So you have the nationalist school and you have the Dutch school. Why Dutch? Well, like I said, the only people that were allowed to come in were the Dutch. And some of the Dutch began bringing in Dutch books. For example, medical books. If you've never studied it, during the 18th century, the 1700s, the European medical standards experienced a revolution where doctors tried actually figuring out how the human body works. And they wrote very detailed books. Well, some of these medical books were smuggled in Japan, and they're like, okay, the Chinese medical books talked about balance and humors and acupuncture, herbal remedies, whereas the European books are telling people how to do surgery based on realistic depictions of what's inside a human being. So what should we use? Something that's real or something that's kind of, All right, so what ended up happening was both advocated for getting rid of the Chinese stuff. But when you put these two groups together, some were saying, all we need is Japan, and some were saying, well, we can add some other things. But there would be tensions between traditionalists and reformers. And we're going to deal with that when we come back. Questions? All right, so warning. Obviously, you're going away for Easter. We don't have class on Thursday. Easter is the deadline for early submission. One person in here submitted their paper. I got to grade it. Your last chance to get extra points on your paper is, of course, Easter. When we come back, I only got Japanese stuff, not much Japanese stuff. I don't know if I'm going to be able to get into a class. Might take me two, but that means that the week after Easter is going to be exam number 3. So if you've missed any classes, all of the lectures have been posted. So make sure you go and get the information that you missed. Have a wonderful Easter break. Eat lots of food. Hopefully you can also remember the reason for the season.